The golden age of radio is on the air. Morehead State Public Radio presents classic old-time radio programs from radio's golden age, the 1930s through the 1950s. On this program of the golden age of radio, the air adventures of Jimmy Allen from 1937 and the friendly five footnotes from 1931. We'll also hear about the absent-minded professor on an episode of Secrets of Scotland Yard. Stay tuned for the golden age of radio after today's news from NPR on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Later on today's show, the air adventures of Jimmy Allen, friendly five footnotes, and an episode of Secrets of Scotland Yard. Right now, here's Gene Autry singing South of the Border from 1939 as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
South of the Border, down Mexico way, that's where I fell in love when stars above came out to play. And now as I wander, my thoughts ever stray south of the border, down Mexico way. She was a picture in old Spanish lace. Just for a tender while, I kissed the smile upon her face. For it was fiesta, and we were so gay. South of the border, down Mexico way. Then she sighed as she whispered mañana, never dreaming that we were parting. And I lied as I whispered mañana, for our tomorrow never came. South of the border, I rode back one day. There in a veil of white by candlelight she knelt to pray. But the mission bells told me that I mustn't south of the border, down Mexico way. Ay, 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 ay,
Allen has plenty to think about these days. His flying instructor, the disagreeable and impatient Shorty Mason, tells him that his air work is almost hopeless. Jimmy wonders if he'll ever learn to fly. The lad is also worried about the hint of suspicion that has been thrown upon his great friend, Speed Robertson. What does Speed know about the missing plans for the new jet-propelled Army fighter? Then, too, just who is the strange Oriental Major Moto? Well, let's see what's happening to Jimmy. We find him standing beside his training ship talking with Flash Lewis, the droll mechanic. Jimmy is waiting for his instructor to appear.
You can't prove it by me, Jimmy. All them guys from Manchuria and China and Japan looks alike to me.
But, Flash, does Major Moto seem to know much about airplanes?
Say, them slant-eyed babies sometimes look dumb, but their old thinking apparatus is turning over at 2,400 revolutions a minute. I learned that in the Pacific, and don't you ever forget it.
He seems smart enough, but he never says anything. I just can't seem to get acquainted with him at all.
Well, what do you care about Major Moto? He ain't bothering you, is he?
No, nothing like that. He's always very polite and, well, respectful, you know. But, well, I just can't dope him out.
Well, all I know is that his government sent him here to learn to fly. But listen, kid, you got other things to think about. Here comes that ding-dong instructor of yours. The Honorable Shorty Lindbergh Doolittle Eaker Smith Mason. The world's greatest flyer. Ha! Well, I'd better wipe off this powerful training plane that you and Shorty's gonna fly this morning.
Gee, Mr. Mason looks kind of sour. He must have climbed out the wrong side of the bed.
Looks like a rough morning for the students of good old Central Flying School. Oh, never mind, Jimmy. There's worse things than Shorty Mason to put up with. Why, once I had scarlet fever.
Good morning, Mr. Mason.
Morning, Ellen. I suppose you sat up all night studying that book of yours on how to fly.
Oh, no, sir. I had a good night's rest last night. I feel just fine this morning.
Maybe a good rest will improve your flying. It needs something.
Is my air work showing any improvement at all, Mr. Mason?
No, it's getting worse.
Can you make any suggestions that will help it, sir? I'm willing to do anything.
The trouble with you, Ellen, you don't pay any attention to what I tell you. You're one of these smart crackers who thinks he knows everything. You come down here with the idea that you was going to show me how to fly.
Oh, I beg your pardon, Mr. Mason. I've never had any such intentions.
Just because you got mixed up in an airline robbery and got your picture in the paper and got to running around with that big ham Speed Robertson.
Now, wait a minute, Mr. Mason. I'm willing to admit my flying's bad, but I think you'll have to admit that I'm trying just as hard as I possibly can. And I certainly didn't come down to the school here to get
installed. I'll save all that. I know what you're going to say. And I'm going to tell you another thing, Alan.
Oh, good morning, Mr. Mason. Isn't it a gorgeous day for flying? Simply gorgeous. A beautiful day for you brave and intrepid birdmen.
Shut your mouth, Flash. I suppose you're trying to be funny. Well, you're about as funny as a cry for help.
Oh, pardon me, Mr. Mason. Excuse my glove. I was just trying to start the day pleasantly for you.
Yeah? Well, put a gag in that big mouth of yours. Say, Alan, how are you getting on with your ground school course?
All right, I think. You see, I spent quite a bit of time studying before I came to the school.
I suspected that. Well, answer this question. What are the five component parts of an airplane?
The five integral parts of an airplane? Oh, that's easy, Mr. Mason. There's the power unit, or engine and propeller, that's one. The landing gear, or chassis, is two. The wing, or wings, is three. The fuselage is four, and the tail group is five. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that's correct, all right. Well, I'm glad you're learning something. I don't seem to be able to pound anything about flying into your head.
Oh, really, I think I've learned quite a bit. I guess I seem pretty awkward, though. Oh, here comes Mr. Jones.
Yeah. I wonder what the boss wants. Hello, Mike.
Howdy, Shorty. Hello there, Jimmy.
Good morning, Mr. Jones.
Oh, Shorty. You and Alan getting ready for a hop?
Yeah, I was just going to start the engine.
I see. Better wait a minute. Say, Jimmy, I want you to do a little errand for me. Better take Flash Lewis with you. Flash, you go along with Jimmy Allen and see if you can find a flying jacket in my car. It's parked over in back of the administration building.
Okay, Mike.
I can go over alone, Mr. Jones. I know your car when I see it.
Oh, you better take Flash with you. He knows where I park my car.
Just as you say. But I can go over alone and then you won't have to take Flash away from his work.
I said take Flash. Now get along.
All right. Come on, Flash.
It's that brown flying jacket of mine, Flash. I think it's in the back seat.
Okay, Mike.
What's the big idea, Mike? I saw your jacket hanging up in the office.
Yeah? Well, never mind that. Now, look here, Shorty. How's young Alan getting on with his flying?
Well, to tell you the truth, he's doing all right.
Mm.
That lad's a smart kid. Don't fool yourself about that. And he's going to make a smooth pilot, too.
Yeah, I was afraid of that. Don't be telling me how smart he is. I know.
What have you got on your mind, Mike?
This kid is too smart. Get it? He knows too much. Altogether too much.
You think so?
Mason, I don't think it. I know it. He and Robertson messed up one deal. And now what do you think has happened?
Go ahead. I'll bite.
After me and Moto landed yesterday, young Allen starts giving Moto the question box. Now do you begin to see the light?
What? You mean he suspects that Moto...
Shut up. Don't start thinking out loud here or anywhere else. I don't know exactly how much the kid knows or how much he suspects. But whatever it is, it's too much. Get it?
Maybe you're right, Mike. You know the picture better than I do.
I'll say I do. And I don't want this picture smeared up. Now listen, Shorty. Could Allen get this training ship off the ground? Could he fly it alone?
Great guns, Mike. Do you mean turn the kid loose?
I mean this, Shorty. We can't afford to have our plans messed up. And what could be more natural than one of those unfortunate aviation accidents? See?
But, Mike, we're taking a chance.
Listen, Mason. You got to take chances in this racket.
I know it, Mike, but the kid's pretty good. What if he got up and down okay?
Well, if he should, we'll have to try.
Well, listen, Mike, I got it. I think I can fix that. Now, wait a minute. I think I got a small wrench in my pocket.
Hey, wait a minute. What are you going to do?
Come on over here by the landing gear. There, now stand in front of me, Mike. This is worth trying.
Oh, I see. Not a bad idea, Shorty. Hurry up, though. They're coming back.
One's enough, Mike, and I think it'll work.
Come on, hurry up. They're coming.
Okay, that ought to do it. Now leave the rest to me.
Well, I don't know why we couldn't find it. We certainly looked all over.
Well, boys, couldn't you find the jacket?
We looked all through the car, Mr. Jones. There's no flying jacket there.
That's funny. Thought I left it in the car. Oh, well, never mind.
Well, it sure ain't in the car, Mike.
All right, let it go. Oh, say, Jimmy. Shorty Mason tells me you're getting along swell with your flying. He says you're the best student he ever had.
He said what? Why, I don't understand. He told me just this morning that he thought...
Oh, Jimmy, I was just kidding you. Just kidding you. I do that with all my students. So they won't get overconfident.
Oh, gee, I'm certainly glad to hear that.
Sure, kid. You're doing great. Why, Shorty tells me you're all ready to solo. Well, got to be getting back to my office. Come along with me, Flash. Got a job for you in the shop. And Shorty, it's a nice, calm morning. If you say it's okay, let Jimmy solo. Bye. Be seeing you later.
Gee, thanks, Mr. Jones. But, Mr. Mason, I didn't think my flying...
Oh, that's all right, kid. You've been doing a great job of flying. You're all right. In fact, you're ready to solo. I think I'll send you out alone right now.
But I haven't had any takeoffs or landings. Oh, I don't think I'm ready to solo.
Sure you're ready to solo. Why, you'll get this ship up and down without any trouble at all. That's the easiest part of flying anyway.
Well, I wouldn't want to try it before I had some instructions in landing.
Oh, so you don't want to solo, eh? You're losing your nerve, eh, Ellen? I thought you was yellow. I thought you was the kind
now,
of kid...
Now, look here,
that...
Mason. I'm not yellow. I'm not afraid to take this ship off and land it. But I do think I should have some instructions in landing.
If you're not yellow, what's the big idea of putting on the baby act with me?
All right. I'll solo the ship. And I'll get it up and down, too.
Now you're talking like a man. All right, get up there in the cockpit and get it started. You know how, and there ain't much wind. You could take off from the line right here.
That suits me, okay.
All clear. Come on, get it started. All right, turn her around and hit her right down the field. And land her out there on the north-south runway.
Roger. I'll make it all right.
Look at the kid take off that ship.
Hey,
that is pretty good at that, isn't it, Mike? Watch yourself, Shorty. Here comes Speed Robertson. That's a bad break.
Hey, what ship was that just took off?
That's Jimmy Allen making his first solo.
What? You mean Jimmy Allen's alone on that ship? Why, he isn't ready to solo. Are you crazy, Mason?
Listen, Robertson, I'm his instructor. I know what I'm doing.
You dirty pup.
Hey, Speed, look. What's that falling away from Jimmy's ship?
Great Scott, a wheel. One of the wheels has come off the landing gear.
What in the world will happen to Jimmy now? The young student, alone in the airplane, with no training or experience to help him to a safe landing and a damaged landing gear. Many breathtaking thrills are in store for us in the next episode of The Air Adventures of Jimmy Allen.
Gentlemen, on your toes. Friendly Five Footnotes are on the air, and Friendly Fred is introducing them with his own original tap dance. One, two, three, four, five. Count them. Five Friendly Five footnotes sent to you by the makers of Friendly Five shoes for men in conjunction with the Friendly Five shoe dealer in your own neighborhood. Here is the first. A note to students in every high school and college in the country. We want to thank you for the way you've taken to Friendly Five footwear. We know that comfort isn't the only thing you're looking for when you buy shoes. You're thinking of style, lasting quality, and economy. We take it as a tribute to Friendly Fives that they have met so heartily with your approval. Second footnote, for the benefit of those who wish to take a tip from college men, Friendly Fives may be had in over 70 styles, ranging from the small size 3 to the unusually large 15, and in widths from the extra narrow quadruple A to the extremely wide quadruple E. Third footnote, Casey Jones is going to add some air notes to the program. Fourth footnote, the Friendly Five Orchestra is anxious to begin the first number. And fifth, the first number, it's the girl. Friendly Fred sang that chorus. And now for the popular number, Sweet and Lovely.
must have sent her my way. Skies above me never were as blue as her eyes, and she loves me. Who would want a sweeter surprise? When she nestles in my arms so tenderly, there's a thrill that words cannot express. In my heart a song of love is taunting me, melody haunting me. Sweet and lovely, sweeter than the roses in May, and she loves me. There is nothing more I can say.
And now, in the usual Friendly Five manner of putting the right foot forward, we introduce Casey Jones, the world-renowned aviator and vice president of the Curtiss Wright Corporation, who will tell you some more interesting facts concerning aviation. Ladies and gentlemen, Casey Jones.
Hello, folks. Casey Jones speaking. The year 1931 has marked the introduction of a new type of airplane for private use known as the light plane. These little machines, carrying one or two passengers, are powered by motors developing 30 to 50 horsepower, and are the result of a demand for an airplane of moderate price, which can be operated at a cost comparable with that of a motor car. One of these machines is the Curtiss Wright Jr., which carries two people and sells for $1,500. It has a top speed of 80 miles per hour, cruises at 70, lands at 30, and makes 25 miles to the gallon of gas. Try this on your automobile. Because of its ease of handling, experienced pilots are constantly tempted to take unnecessary chances with it. As a result, some accidents have occurred, due not to any defect of the ship, but to carelessness on the part of the pilot. Naturally, machines of this type have certain limitations, similar in a way to those of a small motorboat. The owner of such a craft would not think of venturing out when heavy seas were running, and the aircraft owner must recognize its limitations and exercise patience. The machine serves a very useful purpose by providing economical method of learning to fly and bringing pleasure flying within the reach of the pocketbook of thousands who could not otherwise afford it. A new development in this field is the light amphibian. The fuselage is built in the form of a boat with wheels that can be raised and lowered. The construction is similar to that of a canoe. Practically all of our cities are located on the water, and the production of a machine which costs no more to operate than an automobile opens up tremendous possibilities in the field of commuting between homes along the shore directly to the city. This development offers countless opportunities to the sportsman. Isolated lakes situated 200 or 300 miles in the country, inaccessible to other modes of transportation, will be within commuting distance. Businessmen who have summer places on the lakes, where they are now able to spend only weekends, can make daily trips, requiring no more time than ordinarily necessary to reach their home in the suburbs. Thus, low-priced machines will tend to popularize private flying as the low-priced car popularized motoring.
Thank you, Casey, for those air notes. And now back to our footnotes again. Another dance tune, It's Great to Be in Love from the Vanities, played by special permission of the copyright owners.
Skies are always sunny, and life is sweet. sweet as honey. You can't buy it with money. It's great to be in love. Oh, you learn how to take, learn how to give, learn how to love, and you learn how to live. Oh, it's great to get that feeling. And oh, boy, what a feeling. It sets your senses reeling. It's great to be in love.
There you are. That brings to a close our five Friendly Five footnotes sent to you through the courtesy of your local Friendly Five shoe dealer and the Friendly Five shoe manufacturers. Did you notice the absence of advertising talk in this program? It was as easy on your mind as Friendly Five shoes are on your feet. By the way, have you sent for your copy of the book, It's Easy to Learn to Fly? It's handsomely illustrated and explains the rudiments of aviation. It is being distributed by the sponsors of this program as a part of their contribution towards making the world air-minded. Now for Friendly Fred's appropriate closing signature, I've got $5.
You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio with the Friendly Five footnotes from 1931. We also heard an episode of The Air Adventures of Jimmy Allen from 1937, and Gene Autry sang South of the Border from 1939. Stay tuned for more classic old-time radio from the 1930s through the 1950s. When the Golden Age of Radio continues on Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Right now, the absent-minded professor on an episode of Secrets of Scotland Yard, as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
How do you do? This is Clive Crook. Today I want to tell you something about the special branch of Scotland Yard. I expect you've heard of it. Judging from some detective novels, you'd imagine it consisted of a group of super Sherlock Holmeses who are called in when everything else has failed. But that is not true, is it, Percy?
No, Clive. The special branch of Scotland Yard is a unit of a couple of hundred men who specialize in political crimes. They differ from their colleagues of the Criminal Investigation Department in that they must be able to speak several languages.
In fact, the function of the special branch, in official language, is to guard the security of the state.
Or, as the boys themselves put it, to clear up political nuisances.
So today, a special branch man may find himself guarding the king or the prime minister, probing the antecedents of political refugee who seeks the protection of British nationality, tracking down the perpetrators of a bomb outrage, or sauntering among the guests at a royal garden party.
Clive, why don't you tell them the story of the absent-minded professor?
All right, Percy, I will. It's a story which shows the far-reaching significance of political crime and how, wherever an international conspiracy may start, sooner or later its tentacles will come within the reach of the long arm of the special branch of Scotland Yard. Ottawa, Canada, September 1945. One war is over, but for at least one of the great powers, another war, a secret war of information, a nerve war, has never ceased. It is late in the evening, and the offices of the Canadian Ministry of Justice are almost deserted. The last few employees are on the way home, and one of the officials is evidently trying to get rid of a late visitor.
See you, sir, but I'm afraid there's really nothing I can do about it. Why don't you write us a letter?
But you don't understand.
I'm very sorry, sir, but I'm afraid I have to go now.
Okay.
Thanks for calling
but
you.
But please.
I'm very sorry.
Yeah.
Phew, I thought I'd never get rid of that guy.
What do you want?
Oh, some screwball. Said he came from the Soviet embassy. Wanted to show me some secret documents.
You're kidding.
No, but I guess he was. Tried to tell me all about some fifth column. Crazy guy.
What's his name?
Oh, I don't know. Here, here's a slip he sent in. Ooh. Igor G.O.U. Gozenko.
Igor Guzenko, 25-year-old cipher clerk, employed in the code room of the military section of the Soviet embassy in Ottawa. Igor Guzenko, a man whose story was to shock the world, a man whose information was to bring to justice traitors of three nations who'd endeavored to betray the Allies' greatest secret, the atom bomb. But this September night, Igor Guzenko is finding it very hard to tell his story. Nobody believes him. And yet all the time, he knows that at the Soviet embassy, his desertion will have been discovered.
Inspector McLean. Where? Who's that? Guzenko's. Well, who are these guys breaking in? Hmm? From the Soviet embassy. Searching the place, eh? Well, listen, have you traced Guzenko? Oh, you picked him up. Oh, he wanted to be arrested. Well, don't blame him. Well, now, listen, hold on to Guzenko and all his papers. Get hold of his family and don't let anybody see him. Yeah. Well, move him out of town and come back to me for instructions. Now, remember, nobody must see Guzenko.
In a matter of hours, it was clearly established that not only were Guzenko's documents genuine, but that they included copies of four recent and secret telegrams exchanged between the British and Canadian governments on highly confidential matters.
And realizing the complete freedom which exists in Canada and convinced that the Communist Party in democratic countries has changed long ago from a political party into an agency net for the Soviet government, a fifth column in these countries to meet a war, I decided that I could no longer serve my government but must at last speak the truth.
The Canadian police authorities found in Guzenko's documents a fascinating story of how, in secret code, the Soviet military attaché in Ottawa had given information and received instructions from Moscow.
Message to Zavotil, Ottawa. Your immediate objectives are 1. The atomic bomb, its composition and technological processes. 2. A sample of uranium-235. 3. The library and secret documents of the National Research Council. 4. Latest developments of electronic fuses for shells, radar, and a super explosive known as RDX.
Reporting to Moscow. Facts are given by Alec. 1. The test of the atomic bomb was conducted in New Mexico. The bomb dropped on Japan was made of uranium-235. 2. Alec handed over to us a sample of uranium-235. 3. Alec has also reported brief data concerning electronic shells. There is in the shell a small radio transmitter with one electronic tube, and it is fed by dry batteries. The body of the shell is the antenna.
Moscow to Sabota. Work out and telegraph arrangements for the meeting and password of Alec with our man in London.
Sabota to Moscow. Alec will work in King's College, Strand. Meetings, October 7, 17, 27, on the street in front of the British Museum. The time, 11 o'clock in the evening. Identification sign, a newspaper under the left arm. Password, best regards to Mackel.
But even Moscow realized that their boys in Britain might have rather a busy evening identifying Alec from the number of Londoners with newspapers under their arms in Museum Street at 11 o'clock in the evening. They replied,
arrangements not satisfactory. Correction. Facing British Museum. Intersection Great Russell Street, Museum Street. Time, 8 o'clock, October 7, 17th, 27. Identification signs. Alec will have under his left arm the newspaper Times. The contact man will have in his left hand the magazine Picture Post. Convey instructions to Alec.
Convey instructions to Alec. Who was Alec? The Canadian police authorities at once placed the facts of this alarming leakage of atomic secrets before Prime Minister Mackenzie King. Realizing the grave implications of the plot, Mr. King hastened to Washington to acquaint President Truman with the situation. 4 days later, the Canadian Prime Minister crossed the Atlantic and repeated the story to British Premier Mr. Clement Attlee. Officials of British military intelligence were called to Downing Street. The investigation was entrusted to Lieutenant Colonel Leonard Burt. Burt, a pre-war yard chief, was seconded to the War Office at the beginning of the war for anti-sabotage work. Incidentally, today he's back at the yard in command of the special branch. The colonel's immediate and priority mission was to identify Alec.
Well, I don't expect we shall have much trouble finding out who Alec is. Our main problem is going to be to get him, to find out how much he knows, and even more important, how much he has told.
Yes, sir.
Well, let's have a look at those cables again. Here we are. Alec will work in King's College, Strand. Give me the phone directory.
Here we are, sir.
Thank you. Okay. Well, hello, King's College. Now, put me through to the principal's office, will you? Thank you. Oh, hello. This is Lieutenant Colonel Burt of the War Office. I wonder if you could help me. It's just a routine inquiry. I want to know whether you have on your staff at the moment a physicist who has recently worked in Canada. You have? Oh, good. He went with a research group on a project in Montreal, and he's just come back to London. Good. And what's his name? Dr. Nun May. Thank you, that'll be all. Oh, sounds like our man.
And October the 7th looks like our day, sir.
4 days from now, we'll have to get busy.
As October the 7th approached, a number of well-built but unobtrusive men began renting rooms in Museum Street. Rooms with first-floor windows which looked out onto the forecourt of the British Museum. In this and many other ways, known only to MI5 and the special branch, every inch of the place of rendezvous was covered by one or two observers.
Inspector Burt?
Sergeant Wilson here, sir.
All right, Wilson. I know you haven't seen him.
Not a sign, sir.
That's not surprising. I've just had a report from the man who shadowed him from King's College. He left there at 6:30, went straight home, had supper, and according to his last call, he's now sitting in front of the fire.
On October the 7th, they drew a blank, but they still had two more chances. Dr. Nun May was shadowed constantly, but always unobtrusively. On October the 17th and again on the 27th, the watchers by the British Museum kept their vigil, but Dr. Nun May did not keep his appointment.
It's no use, Wilson. He must have been warned.
Do you think he's suspicious, sir?
Oh, he may know he's being watched, but I don't think so. Not yet, anyway.
What do you mean, not yet, sir?
I think it's about time Dr. Nun May and I had a little talk. I'm going round to King's College. How do you do, Professor? My name is Burt, Inspector Burt of Military Intelligence.
How do you do? Military Intelligence, did you say?
Oh, that's right. I don't want to waste your time, Professor, so I'll come straight to the point. Are you aware that there's been a leakage of confidential information in Canada relating to atomic energy?
Really, Inspector? I don't know what to say. Certainly, it's the first I've heard of it.
The first you've heard of it?
Of course, I must say, Inspector, I don't read the papers very much.
I wasn't suggesting that you'd have read it in the papers. I was wondering whether you'd had some first-hand knowledge.
What do you mean, Inspector?
Just this. I want you to answer one or two questions for me. During the period you spent in Canada in connection with the Atomic Energy Commission,
Were you approached at any time or by any person to give information concerning your work?
Certainly not, and I think I should say, Inspector, that if the Department of the War Office you represent is concerned with counter-espionage or anything of that nature, I'm not prepared to answer any of your questions.
But you do say that you were not approached and did not give any information whatsoever.
That is correct.
Inspector Burt sensed that despite his answers in his bold front, the little professor was rather worried. When the special branch finds that a suspect is worried, they usually proceed to worry him just a little more.
All right, Wilson. There are your instructions starting tomorrow. I want the men in Stafford Street and everybody who's covering Nunn May to change their technique. So far, their aim has been to be as unobtrusive as possible. From tomorrow, I want Dr. Nunn May to know that he's being watched. So the men of MI5, under the direction of Inspector Burt, began the next phase of the war they were conducting against the little professor. In the next few days, the shadowing was performed in a manner scarcely creditable to the reputation of Scotland Yard. Meantime, a message had been sent to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who were instructed to inquire how closely Dr. May's travels had fitted into the pattern outlined for Alec in the cables which had been intercepted between Moscow and Ottawa.
Royal Canadian Mounted Police to Burt, Special Branch, Scotland Yard. Information supplied by Dr. John Douglas Cockcroft, Chief of the Atomic Energy Project at Montreal, shows Dr. May made several trips to the nuclear research laboratories of the Manhattan Project at Chicago, coinciding entirely with the reports from Alec. Dr. May left for England within a few days of his last trip to the research laboratories and is scheduled to return for a month's work next year. Everything checks up with the information in our possession concerning Alec.
Yes, and the signal goes on to say that no other scientist has followed the same schedule or is planning to return next year. Yes, everything fits. It must be Dr. Nunn May.
Meantime, officials of the United States Federal Bureau of Investigation had entered the story. The information concerning Dr. May was sent to the headquarters of the Manhattan Engineer District in Washington, D.C.
One of the fundamental principles of United States military intelligence is that personnel on secret projects are entitled to know only as much as they require to carry on their work. Thus, months before, when the National Research Council of Canada had proposed that Dr. May be allowed to visit the United States for 1 month, the application had been placed before General Groves personally.
The general had sent for the file on Dr. May. It included the information that Dr. May had already visited the Chicago Atomic Research Laboratories 3 times. And that this third visit occurred between September 25 and October the 30th, 1944. He carried on extensive work in collaboration with other scientists in a highly secret and important new field. His work resulted in a research report in which he collaborated with an American scientist. To Groves, a fourth visit by May to the United States ran counter to security principles, for it would allow him to know too much of what was going on in widely separated projects. Accordingly, the answer had gone back, polite but firm, no. If vital secrets in the field of atomic energy still rest secure, credit must be given to General Groves' decision to bar Dr. May. For as the Canadian Royal Commission of Inquiry had stated,
the Soviets failed to obtain details on the structure of the atomic bomb only because there was no one in Canada who could tell them.
That all this was in the future. Back in London in September 1945, Lieutenant Colonel Burt had still to complete his case against Dr. Nunn May. After waiting for 1 more week, during which the professor must have been well aware that he was being shadowed by the Yard, the colonel went back to see the professor again.
So you see, Professor, I thought it would be a good idea if I came back to have another little talk with you.
Yes.
Yes. You see, I wanted to tell you that we know that you had an appointment to meet someone in the vicinity of the British Museum shortly after your return from Canada.
Well?
Who was that person? And why didn't you keep the appointment?
Yes, you're quite right. I didn't keep the appointment.
And who was the person?
When I came back to London, I decided to wash my hands of the whole business.
What business?
The matter this person was going to see me about.
It's no use, Professor. You see, we know too much.
I tell you, I have nothing more to say.
I think you will have something more to say. And I am quite prepared to wait until you are ready to say it.
I absolutely refuse. If you think you can persuade me into making some sort of statement...
Inspector Byrd didn't think. He knew. He realized that a man like Dr. Nunn May, conscious of the fact he was being followed, nervous and frightened,
would in the end have to come clean. Well, Dr. Nunmay didn't tell the whole truth, but at least he started to tell part of the truth, and at the end of this interview, he gave a long statement.
About a year ago, whilst in Canada, I was contacted by an individual whose identity I declined to divulge. He called on me at my private apartment in Swale Avenue, Montreal. He apparently knew I was employed by the Montreal laboratory, and he sought information from me concerning atomic research. I gave and had given very careful consideration to correctness of making sure that development of atomic energy was not confined to the USA. I took the very painful decision that it was necessary to convey general information on atomic energy and make sure that it was taken seriously. For this reason, I decided to entertain a proposition made to me by the individual who called on me. After this preliminary meeting, I met the individual on several subsequent occasions in Canada. He made specific requests for information which were just nonsense to me.
What do you mean by that?
I could not understand what he was talking about.
Did he ask you for samples of uranium?
Yes, and for information generally on atomic energy.
And do you admit to giving him samples?
Yes. At one meeting, I gave the man microscopic amounts of U-233 and U-235, one of each. The U-235 was a slightly enriched sample and was in a small glass tube and consisted of about a milligram of oxide. The U-233 was about a tenth of a milligram and was a very thin deposit on a platinum foil and was wrapped in a piece of paper.
What else did you give him?
I also gave him a written report on atomic research as known to me. This information was mostly of a character which has since been published or is about to be published.
Anything else?
The man also asked for information about the American electronically controlled ACAC shells.
And what did you do?
I knew very little about these and so could only give very little information.
And what did he give you?
He gave me some dollars. I accepted these against my will.
I see. Is that the end of your statement?
Yes.
So much for the professor's statement. The special branch of Scotland Yard had already unearthed more incriminating evidence.
Dr. Nunmay, etc. Ardent communist. Yes, just what I expected. I see they picked up 8 of his friends in Canada. And do you see this, Wilson? The doctor visited other atomic projects at the request of the Soviet embassy. Well, I think our case is ready now. It's about time we brought in the director of public prosecutions. Bring in all the other files on the case.
The sentence upon you is one of 10 years penal servitude.
Well, that isn't quite the end of the story, because after the trial, there were many protests that the sentence was out of all proportion to the magnitude of the offense committed. The Association of Scientific Workers issued a statement in which they declared,
"We do not seek to justify Dr. May's breach of the Official Secrets Act, but we are convinced, from our knowledge of Dr. May, that his action was determined only by the principle that fundamental scientific data should have been shared with a country that was not only friendly, but a fighting ally. The only work in which Dr. May was engaged, and on which he could have been in a position to give unauthorized information, concerned fundamental scientific data relating to atomic energy. Dr. May had no connection whatever with problems of the construction of the atomic bomb and could not have been able to reveal information on atomic bomb manufacture."
What about that, Bertie? Oh, and by the way, I was going to ask you, why do you call this the case of the absent-minded professor?
Because, Clive, while the professor may have been internationally minded about the secrets of atomic energy, you must remember he also gave away the secrets of electronic shells.
You've got something there, Percy. But you know what these absent-minded professors are? Which reminds me of a story.
Time's up, Clive.
Yes, I'm afraid it is. But I have to leave it until next week. Well, that's all for today. This is Clive Brook saying goodbye and pleasant dreams.
the golden age of radio on WMKY, Billie Holiday with Teddy Wilson and his orchestra with What a Little Moonlight Can Do from 1935. We also heard an episode of Secrets of Scotland Yard. This has been the golden age of radio, classic old-time radio programs from the 1930s through the 1950s. Material for this program provided by the Internet Archive, an online nonprofit library of books, movies, music, and old-time radio shows. On the web at archive.org. Tune in again for the Golden Age of Radio next week at the same time and channel on WMKY at 90.3 FM and online at WMKY.org.